There's probably less known about the religions of Egypt than of any other major spiritual tradition which has contributed to the cultural progress of mankind. Until very recently, almost no available data opened itself to our attention or was available to scholars. The earlier material was largely derived from Greek or Latin sources, and the old Egyptian culture, which flourished prior to the 18th dynasty, is still a locked book. It reminds us a little of the rather deplorable state of our knowledge of ancient American religions. The cultures of Mexico, Central America, and Peru are still closed to us, with the exception of a few fragments, which give very little real insight into the structure of a religious belief. We observe the remains of the Egyptian Empire. We note the impressive monuments, the great architectural and artistic achievements of the people of the Valley of the Nile. We also note that a very large part of the surviving memorials are directly or indirectly associated with religion. These peoples created a magnificent religious art and architecture. And it seems reasonable to assume that these same people must have had some convictions or beliefs to justify the tremendous advancements which they made in science and even sociology. Their greatest exponents were the Greeks. And it would seem that during the classical period, Greek scholars never ceased their praise of Egyptian wisdom. Men of the caliber of Pythagoras and Plato spoke most eulogistically of the spiritual attainments of Egypt. And in government and law, Solon and Thales bear witness to the common practice that men of learning and ability, faced with responsibility or high office, nearly always traveled to Egypt to be there instructed by the priests of the temple. Men who have given much time to Egyptian archaeology and culture, such as Breasted of the British Museum, Breasted of the University of Chicago, and Budge of the British Museum, both had a very high respect for Egyptian religion. But while Budge was working quietly in the shaded archives of the library of the British Museum and was curator of its Egyptian section, another man in the same institution, Dr. Hall, probably working side by side with Breasted from the same monument, from the same text, came to an entirely contrary conclusion He was far from impressed by Egyptian religion. So here we find two men, the same background, working in the same institution, who have no common agreement. I think this is the general condition so far as Egypt is concerned. Let us try then, from what available information we have, to piece together some part of the Egyptian religious story. And when we begin this, we have to go back to the roots of Egyptian culture. Here again, we are at a disadvantage. No one has exposed these roots. We really do not know where the great civilization of Egypt began in the pattern of history, nor do we know the source or roots of its spiritual beliefs. It is all right to assume, and we may have to, that these beliefs evolved, developed, and grew with the rise of Egyptian civilization itself, and that the primitive Egyptian, like the primitive Ashanti, held certain simple beliefs which gradually developed into the elaborate structures of the Middle Empire. On the other hand, there is much to suggest that religion was imported to Egypt at a very early date. There seems a good many traces and evidences to point to Egypt's indebtedness to India and probably to Persia for a large part of its spiritual tradition. This may not have been at the very beginning, but it certainly did come into play prehistorically so far as existing monuments and records are concerned. The Egyptians themselves had a tradition that their religion came from Asia. There seems no real reason to question this tradition, for most peoples, if they can claim a belief to themselves, will not assign it to others. If the Egyptians really believed that their doctrines arose among their own people, they would certainly have held this honor to themselves. They did not do so, perhaps in honesty. They admitted their dependence upon foreign beliefs. Egypt, of course, was not isolated as China was, and in the course of time it felt religious influence from a number of surrounding sources of culture. It was affected certainly by the Assyrian and Babylonian culture, and at one time came heavily under the influence of the Semite culture. As time went on, the Egyptian metropolis of Alexandria became an important station along the great caravan route from Asia. We are not sure how early these caravan routes were opened, but certainly as early as 500 to 600 BC, probably much earlier. We know that far beyond Egypt, moving in an easterly direction, we came upon a number of great cultures that were firmly established at a remote time. We do not know when China actually became a philosophic people, but we are reasonably certain that it was not later than 1500 to 2000 BC, probably earlier. We know that Indian culture is this old, if not older. We are quite confident, therefore, that Asia had produced advanced religious systems anywhere from 1000 to 2000 BC. These are the conservative figures of modern scholars, having no particular root in any speculation, mystical or otherwise. So there is no reason to doubt that along its life way, Egypt was heavily affected by the importation of outside ideas. It was open to them. It was not necessarily a particularly closed people. They were not highly patriotic, as we think of the term. And as one authority points out, the one trait that seems to be traceable in all ancient Egyptian literature, religion, history, is that these people were happy. They were good-natured, cheerful lot, in spite of the various vicissitudes through which they passed. Like most strongly developed cultures, they had certain freedoms even under powerful autocracies. The average person lived his own life in his own way. They were also people with considerable personal vanity, and many of these fashions which we now have originated among them. They believed in as much luxury as they were able to acquire, but at the same time they were hard working and for the most part probably of what we would term an agricultural or agrarian class. Yet we cannot really take it for granted that any people is able to maintain a cheerful and forthright optimism without some source of strength within itself. These people were not foolish, they were not ignorant, they were not stupid. Therefore, if they had a strong inner sense of value, it was derived from some powerful incentives operating within their own culture. We know very little also about the practice of Egyptian religion. We know only that there were priesthoods. That these priesthoods in the beginning were not very clearly marked, and their privileges were not definitely boundaried as they were at a later time. The priests of Egypt were not exactly conventional archetype of priesthood that we know today. Probably in the beginning, the priestly families were associated with a theocratic state. The pharaoh was a living god. He was under divine guidance, and his deeds were always according to the divine right of kings. He was a god on earth, and somewhere in this mystery, there must have been a god who was a pharaoh in heaven. This type of thinking belongs to most older people. In all probability, the priesthood was originally derived from the aristocracy. Wealthy families and friends, near supporters of the political situation, became influential in the religious duties. It was only after the rise of a very prosperous Egypt that this country set a precedent that was to be followed by most other cultures, namely that of assigning certain incomes to the temples. The temples, therefore, developed something of the quality that we found in Tibet, where the secular part of the culture supported the religious very strongly and very generously. The temples of Egypt received income from certain lands of the state which were assigned to the temples. Therefore, as the conquest of Egypt expanded the empire, as trade enriched it, as commerce brought to it a variety of commodities and luxuries, the wealth of the temple lands increased until many of the temples were extremely rich. This wealth was not derived from the contributions of people as we think today in religion. It is very doubtful if the Egyptians ever took up a collection. What they did, rather, was to serve under a kind of political protection or development. They were subsidized. This had its advantages. This has its advantages, and always has, in a country or in a political system where there's a state religion. This makes it unreasonable and unprofitable for the religion to cater to any passing whim or attitude. It is very hard to buy salvation from a temple that is not in need of money. It is also very difficult to think in terms of the purchasing of indulgences, which caused poor old Martin Luther so much difficulty in Europe. The temple did not need money. This is always a very critical point in religious thinking. Also, there is no doubt that the temple did receive a great deal of unsolicited gifts. Persons of all walks of life felt it part of their normal and reasonable and regular duty to enrich the temple. The gifts, however, were not usually monetary. They were gifts of art. They were gifts of things of sentimental, mystical, or spiritual value. Thus the temples became rich, not in money or things to be sold, but in the treasures that were assembled in these institutions. They need never think of selling the temple plate or anything of that nature. These problems did not touch them any more than they touched the classical Greeks. As a result of this attitude, the function of the temple in society was rather different from what we know. It is not possible to learn that religious services were held in any such way as we hold them. There were no congregations. There was no issue of the Sunday morning hymn program or anything of that nature. Apparently, to each temple was assigned a learned body of priests. These priests were available to the people at all times. This was the simple framework of religion. The individual brought his spiritual need to an individual. He brought his need to a sanctified person who was bound by the obligations of secrecy, who might not divulge, who might not bear witness against him, and had nothing whatever to gain by lengthening or shortening the interview. If the person's problem took 10 years to solve, it was no matter, because the priest was paid to do that particular thing, or subsidized to do it. He lived in the temple. He spent his available time in prayer, meditation, thought, study, or perhaps in one of the various branches of teaching. Here we have something that descended again into the Arabic culture. In most cases, the Egyptian priest was an educator. He was also connected with the faculties of the priestly colleges. And the temple was the college. It was the college, the hospital, the clinic, and in the matters of ordinary private living, it was also the judiciary. Almost all problems that did not relate to the actual political structure of the country were handled by the religious educational group. In the life of the Egyptian people, religion was a very present matter. All of the important events of life had their religious observances, as they do today among primitive people. The various years of life, the changes which take place between childhood and adolescence, between adolescence and maturity, these changes were all marked with ritual. The Egyptian lived within a structure of ritual, and the pageantry of it must have been most impressive. It provided him also, in all probabilities, with a large part of his local entertainment, because the festivals of the religion, the great celebrations, the processionals, the various sacred days and their observances, such as the intercalendary days upon which the first days of the gods were celebrated. All of these were set aside as festivals. In these festivals, the populace took some part, but they were also continuously delighted observers of all the pomp and circumstance that went with these sacred occasions. Because of the very nature of the Egyptian religion, as it seems to have descended to us, it did not bestow upon its people any particular element of fear. Primitive religions usually do not. There may be certain negative fears arise around the ghost cult and things of that nature, but for the most part, the faiths of older peoples were cheerful. They did not have to do with any great fear or doubt concerning the future of things. The average individual perhaps was not too much concerned with even the problem of his own survival after death. Certainly the populace in general either assumed that these matters were adequately taken care of by the great gods upon their distant thrones, or else all that was necessary to be known could be imparted to them by their priests and in the various educational facilities of the nation. We speak of Egyptian religion, but this itself is a more or less misnomer. Actually, the religions of Egypt were many, and at various times in the history of the nation, different sects and creeds emerged to powerful positions. Probably this was partly due to internal strife. There was much of this in the very early periods of Egyptian history. As a result of this strife, certain powerful territories became dominant, others were conquered, and this changed the religious outlook. The victorious army imposed its religion upon the conquered, so that where a state or area came into great authority, its religion likewise developed a broad area of influence. The religions of Egypt were almost as numerous as the temples that housed them. Each community or city or province, called a nome in Egypt, had its own hierarchy of deities. Here again we find a close parallel with the ancient culture in the Greek area. Each city had its patron deity or group of deities, and the temples of these deities gathered around the central square or forum, much as they did in Athens or in Rome. Thus, we cannot say that their theologies were always even nearly identical. One of the first problems that the modern Egyptologist faces in consideration of the religion of this country is the problem of the basis of the religious viewpoint of Egypt. Were the Egyptians monotheists, polytheists, or pantheists? In other words, did they worship one god, did they worship many gods, or did they worship embodied and personified aspects of nature? The tendency now for most religious writers is to deny monotheism wherever possible, trying to reserve it as part of man's more modern spiritual acquirement. Actually, however, I strongly suspect that while Egypt probably had no collective monotheism, that is, at least in its early period, it did not recognize one god over all Egypt. I believe we will find that the nomes or various provinces each recognized a supreme deity in their own pantheon. In other words, each of these separate systems worshipped a certain group of deities, much like the Olympian gods, over this group one presiding, as Zeus of the Greeks or Jupiter of the Latins. There seems to be much to indicate that these people were too advanced culturally to avoid the natural concept that leadership must be invested in one power. But you cannot invest leadership in many powers of equal dignity and importance without chaos. You cannot do it in this world, and they did not believe it could be done in the universe. Somewhere in the universe, there had to lurk this mysterious leadership, this one power before which all other powers must bend in acceptance or obedience. Thus, we may say that in Egypt, the different areas had their own little religions with deities differently named from those of other gnomes. But in many instances, these different deities closely resembling each other, or in some instances, obviously derived from each other. As was the practice of the time, the temple rose in the midst of the cultural life of the community. The temple provided the entire pattern of instruction. And it was usually architecturally so constructed as to serve a number of particular and special purposes. The open courts, or the main parts of the temple, were for public worship. They were also for the enthronement of the divinities. Here, in some way, the deities were represented, usually in magnificent granite or basalt figures. Nearly every one of these temples, by the way, presented their principal deities as a triad, three divinities in certain relationship with each other, constituted the icons of the principal altar of the temple. In addition to this large assembly place, not so much where people gathered in great number, except on festive occasions, but rather where the gods themselves were given ample homes with great dignity, mass, and majesty. In addition, there were smaller buildings scattered about and adjacent to the larger sanctuary. These smaller buildings were the houses of the priests, the granaries, the treasure houses, and perhaps most of all, the schools and academies. Here, learning was communicated. Here, all knowledge, both sacred and secular, was revealed as one essential structure of culture. In other words, the school was the preserver, recorder, and disseminator of the essential tradition of the province, or region, or area. Because these peoples did celebrate certain esoteric or secret rites to which the public was not admitted, meant for the most part that there were beneath these buildings subterranean rooms, passageways, tunnels, and other means of attaining to a secluded or hidden place. It is possible that in some instances where this subterranean situation was impractical due to the inundation of the Nile nearby, that these secret rooms were built upon the surface. But if so, they were closed to the public and to the world and were entered only by secret doorways. In these sanctuary rooms, the particular and special instruction into the great rituals and rites of the gods were communicated. This communication process was usually ritualistic. In other words, the great sacred dramas, as Plutarch calls them, were performed, sometimes at night, in guarded places, including islands where privacy was assured, or if not at night, then in the subterranean and hidden parts of the temple, where the profane and the eavesdropper could not penetrate. Thus we gradually distinguish, as in most instances among these older people, two divisions of religion. The one being that of the public ceremony, and the other that of the private instruction. This was a common policy throughout antiquity, and undoubtedly is responsible for the veneration in which the temple system was so long held. With the changes in the political life of Egypt, there was a more or less drawing together of the state. Finally, Egypt came to be administered as a double empire of Upper and Lower Egypt, and the authority of the state was vested in the pharaoh. Now, in the earlier periods, the pharaoh had a kind of nominal authority, but under an almost complete local system of autonomies. The pharaoh had certain prestige, precedent, authority, and power, but it was largely located in his own city. He could call upon other areas, and they could not refuse his call. But he had very little to do with the shaping or reshaping of the cultural life of the various provinces. These provinces had their own jealous patterns and traditions, which they would not relinquish to any central authority. In other words, in the early period, we might say that the federal government was weak. The right of state extended not only into politics, but into religion. As time passed, however, the same thing occurred in Egypt that happens everywhere else. Namely, that these scattered autonomous states had to be drawn together. They could not defend themselves against the rising tide of conquest from without the boundaries of the country. They could not properly unite in a social, political, or commercial bond. And by degrees, Egypt became essentially one country. In the process of so doing, there emerged from the galaxy of Egyptian faiths the one prominent and dominant religion of the people. A religion, however, that was never the only religion. There was to the very end of Egyptian autonomy the continuance of these various temples, these various shrines, and these various hierarchies of divine beings. But in the course of time, the cult of Osiris began to overwhelm all other religions like a great light rising and causing innumerable candles to lose their own peculiar radiance. And by 1,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era, the Osirian cult came to become almost the idea of Egyptian religion. It became the archetypal concept to which nearly all later peoples subscribed. So that when we think of Egyptian religion today, we are inclined to think of the Osirian cult. This cult was originally the belief of one of the less influential nomes or provinces. But as this province gained in authority, influence, and power, its deities gained likewise. Now, why was it, perhaps, that this particular faith seem to meet the need of the Egyptian to the degree that throughout the entire empire it came to be tolerated at least and generally embraced. I think the answer lies in the fact that the rise of the Osirian cult was associated with a major change in Egyptian religious philosophy. It must have answered and did answer certain questions otherwise obscure. The priesthood of Osiris gained also in authority and influence until it became the most powerful religious body in Egypt. And it became mandatory that the pharaoh of Egypt himself be initiated into the Osirian rites. It was gradually it became the state mysteries. The religion which had the greatest prominence, precedence, and authority in the life of the people. There is a department of religion with which most people are not too well informed and about which there is not too much generally available, and that is called eschatology. This particular branch of religious thinking deals with what might be termed the end of things. In religion, every phase of human experience has to lead to something. And the problem of the ultimate state of things actually is essentially a religious problem. We have tried to make it a scientific problem, but we have only ended by making religion out of science. We have to have certain concepts. Eschatology, for example, asks these questions. What is the end of the world? What is the end of man? What is the state of man after death? What is the ultimate condition of the soul? These things all have to do with some kind of termination or something that lies beyond the circle of the immediate or even the less immediate. We have to go into the state of ultimates. And the problem of spiritual ultimates is covered by the general theme of eschatology. Now, in the Osirian rite of Egypt, we must expect to find a new concept of ultimates. And I suspect that this was the power and influence particularly responsible for the rise of this faith. In the cult of Osiris, we find, for example, the gradual rise of a powerful monotheistic principle. Now, it does not mean that Osiris was technically and actually, in Egyptian religious philosophy, the supreme deity. But by degrees, Osiris became the supremely important deity, the deity most necessary to man, the deity that held in its power and authority the ultimate of man. Also, the Osiris cult had other answers relating to problems that confronted ancient man and which he, to a measure, is still struggling with even today. And that is the problem of the immortality of the human soul. In the Osirian cult, the immortality emerges. It emerges as a spiritual certainty. This, in a way, divides Egypt even from Greece. For immortality arose perhaps later in Greek thinking than it did in Egyptian thinking. The old Egyptians of, say, 1000 B.C. had no clear notion of immortality. They realized that something probably survived, but to them the answer was the ghost land. to the earliest Egyptian with an instinct for survival, it seems to have been believed that the dead lived on in their tombs, and for that reason their worldly goods were buried with them so that they would have everything necessary for their pleasure and convenience. That there was a real sense of immortality as we conceive it today is doubtful prior to the rise of the Osirian cult. It was probably locally taught wherever this cult dominated before it became the principal faith of the empire. The rise of the Osirian cult may also have been strongly influenced by the brief but powerful spiritual impulse given by Akhenaten. This pharaoh, living probably between 1300 and 1400 B.C., certainly was a powerful monotheist. He was one who distinctly and definitely held the concept of one God. Apparently, Egypt at that time was not ready for him, and as a result, his monotheism did not have an endurance. It did survive, however, in mystical and religious groups, and seems to have finally contributed to the ultimate integration of the Osirian cult. So we have in the deity Osiris many of the attributes and aspects that we would normally associate with a supreme being. First of all, we have in him that which is one of the high marks of an ethical civilization, namely a good God. In this case, a good God is one in whom virtues exist that are beyond the common practice of the believers or followers of that God. In other words, Osiris was perhaps cast in the image of man, but he was better than man. He was not merely a stronger chief. He was a nobler ruler. Thus, in Egypt, we begin to clearly observe the rise of the concept of spiritual nobility. That is, the rise of the belief that man lives to become better than he is. This is quite an important point which we take for granted, but we cannot assume was present among ancient beliefs. Gradually also into the Osiris cult came another important element, probably derived partly from Akhenaten, partly from Syria, and partly from Persia. This was the belief that Osiris was not only the good God, but he was a God who loved his children. And furthermore, that men, mortals, humans, were the beloved children of this God, who now takes on the father attribute, is no longer a God with slaves. He is a father with sons. Now this thought is still hard for some people to reconcile in true philosophic insight. We all claim to think this, but in our relationships with life and with religion, we are much more inclined still to think of deity as the autocrat. But in Egypt, the followers of the cult of Osiris began to think of him not only as the good God, but as the wise God, the kindly God, and most of all, in the rise of their religion, the forgiving God. Here, then, we have nearly all of the elements of a highly advanced theological system. We have a deity who emerges as a power, a universal power for good, that in the great struggle of the ages, this good must come to ultimate victory. We have the God of wisdom, in whose nature all mysteries are known, all secrets have their roots, all realizations and revelations originate. we have the deity who has a warm and continuing affection for his creation. And also, as we learn from the various magical manuscripts, the God who understands his creation. So that if men are weak or inadequate, this deity understands this. He is not the cold, stone-faced image against the temple wall. He is the searcher into the hearts of things. He is the fanner of breath in the soul. In addition to these things, this deity is constantly laboring for the ultimate perfection of man, or the rescuing of the world from a state of evil. Undoubtedly, the Egyptians strengthened their philosophy of sin by deriving a certain amount of borrowings from the Semitic people. They also strengthened their belief in the war between good and evil from the doctrines of the Persians. So we have now the good god Osiris, wise and loving, but not all-powerful, who is locked in a bitter struggle with his own brother, Typhon, the destroyer. The struggle of good and evil for victory over the life of man. This is anthropomorphism, a belief which, of course, has been for centuries one of the dominant doctrines of the Christian faith. The struggle of good and evil. But now the eschatology in Egypt says good will vanquish evil. So legends, myths, and fables arose among these peoples, bearing upon the ultimate victory of good over evil. Now the next point that comes into the Egyptian consciousness of Osiris is that Osiris is the lord of the underworld. Osiris is the sun at night. Osiris, therefore, is in some way an embodied deity, represented often wrapped in the wrappings of a mummy, so that he appears to be a living head rising out of a dead body. He is, therefore, the symbol of life-death. He is the symbol of the material world or universe over which he rules, and of which he is the demiurgus or the sovereign power. Osiris now begins to be represented with his attributes, attributes which were to have a great effect upon the religions that followed after him. Standing or seated in his mummified form, wearing his plumed helmet, the crowns of the north and south, Osiris also carries the symbolical ceremonial objects or instruments associated with his faith. These are, first, the flail. The flail, or the whip, was then used primarily not as a symbol of beating or scourging men, but as a symbol of the flailing of grain. It was used to divide the grain from the husk. Therefore, as the flailer, or the beater, Osiris represented the power that divides the false and true, divides the valuable from that which is not valuable, and also divides the soul from the body. The second instrument which he carries is the Anubis-headed staff, by which he is the patron of knowledge or learning, and carries with him the symbol of the faithful guide. Therefore, in this symbolism or this emblemism, Osiris becomes the patron of education, the patron of all knowledge, the patron of insight, the lord of arts and sciences, and he bestows his blessing upon knowledge. In other words, mathematics, astronomy, music, law, medicine, these are also phases of the Osirian cult. He is the Lord of all these things. He is the Lord of the quick and the dead. And by this authority, he governs minds. He governs and regulates peoples. He establishes laws. He sets up the machinery of the universe. Then by his third implement of sacred symbolism, the shepherd's crook, or crozier, Osiris emerges as the high priest, the good shepherd. He is the keeper of the flocks. He is the symbol, therefore, of the protector of the faith, a term which was later bestowed upon the royalties of Europe. He is now the shepherd of men. He is the guardian of the flocks of creation. The world is his sheepfold. He is the shepherd, and all creatures are the sheep. And he also becomes responsible for the lost sheep. And it is his labor and duty through his priests, who are his shepherds, to bring back the lost sheep to the fold. Now, this did not mean reconversion to anything in Egypt, because there was only within a certain province one faith, and all belonged to it. But it was rather to bring back the unbeliever from the evil of his ways, or if he had failed in his religious observances, to bring him back again to the concept of these observances. As I think I've told you before, I talked this over in New York several years ago with the ecumenical patriarch of the Eastern Church, who appears in his full robes and vestments as the head of the Eastern Orthodox Christian Church, carrying the symbols and insignia of Egypt. And he told me himself, he said, "We all know in the Eastern Church that most of our symbolism, our symbolic instruments, our robes, our vestments, and many of our regulations and ceremonies are derived directly from the religion of the ancient Egyptians." Now, this goes a little further, because the Osirian cult gradually unfolds other attributes that are important to us. For in the Osirian religion, the endless conflict between light and darkness, the struggle between Osiris and Typhon for the control of the world, results in the emergence in the Egyptian cult of the world hero. This is the world hero also of the Sigurd saga of the Nordic peoples. This is the great race of the Volsung, the race of the heroes of the world. In the Osirian cult, we have, therefore, the arising of the hero concept, in which this power, this eternal being, Osiris, in order to advance the redemption of men, projects himself into the mortal world, coming forth out of the shadows of Amenhotep, taking himself a flesh of body and being revealed or made manifest through his own nature in the form of an only begotten son. Therefore, in Egypt, Horus, the only begotten of the father, the son of the widow, the most mysterious and immaculately conceived, born of Isis, who was overshadowed by the Holy Spirit of her own murdered husband, Osiris, gave Horus the power to bear witness to his own father throughout all worlds. And in the Egyptian ritual, it is definitely stated that whoever has seen Osiris has seen his son, and whoever has seen his son has seen Osiris. For the Father is in the Son, and the Son is in the Father unto everlastingness. So the projection of Osiris himself comes forth to be the redeemer of men in the form of Horus, the golden hawk. This golden hawk perhaps also derives from the idea of the phoenix. Horus not only becomes the avenger of his father, ultimately restoring the empire to his father, but he also becomes the intercessor, the one who, having taken flesh, having lived among men, and having known the sorrows and secret pains of men, asks that the Father will be patient of men, because he has sent his own Son among them to be like unto them. And Osiris, nearly always, heeds the voice of his Son. And when his Son asks or requests, the Father generally is symbolically represented as acceding to that request. Now, this gives us a very strong foundation for the doctrine of redemption, which was certainly taking form in Egypt by the very earliest contact between the Egyptians and the Latins. Now, out of this comes also another important doctrine rising in the cult of Osiris, and that is the concept of intercession. Here we have now Osiris in his own proper right, and Osiris as the extension of himself in his own Son. This Son gradually becomes, therefore, the peacemaker, the Prince of Peace, to whom the Father will deny nothing. But Osiris now stands in another relationship to this projection of himself. Horus becomes the scapegoat. And in the rituals of the coming forth by day, if the soul which has sinned is in doubt of salvation, Horus steps forth and pleads with his father Osiris, saying, "Let the sins of this man come upon me. Let me be therefore the bearer of his sin. And in my name, and because I have accepted his sin, I ask that you shall forgive him." Now here we have intercession. We have also in this very same concept, as we find in the Egyptian ritual, by the transference of the virtues of Osiris to Horus, and the transference again of these virtues to his priests, who in turn transferred these virtues by their form of the Eucharist, we have rising in Egypt the doctrine of transubstantiation. Thus we now have in this people, and I would say it would be at least 1000 B.C. that this pattern took fairly integrated form, for it is present everywhere in the Theban recension of the Book of the Dead. We have now what might be termed a reasonably complete theology. We have the beginnings of ideas that were to gradually spread to all other parts of the world. And we begin to see how it would be inevitable that this type of thinking would also result in the rise of a mysticism. This is really the crux of our problem, because in the study of mysticism, we then come straight head-on into the problem of the Egyptian mysteries. And of course, as might be expected, our more materialistic